Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Hello, this is Ideas for Democracy, the podcast of International Idea, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, the only intergovernmental organization with a sole mandate to advance democracy in the world. We are here to discuss all things democracy during the pandemic and beyond. I am Kevin Casasamora, the Secretary General of International Idea, and I should add, an elections and politics junkie. And I'm conducting this discussion from our headquarters in Stockholm, Sweden. Already, the COVID-19 pandemic has had multiple consequences for democracy all over the world, with more to come. The impact of the pandemic on elections has been considerable. As we know, many elections have been postponed, while many others have gone ahead in very difficult conditions that deviate considerably from the old normal. One of the many aspects of elections that has experienced and presumably will continue to experience significant changes is international election observation. Over the past generation or so, international observation has become an essential component of elections worldwide. It has become a mechanism to reinforce trust in elections, to alert to problems in the electoral process, to generate proposals to improve the workings of electoral institutions, and on occasion to deflate and even solve election-related conflicts. At the same time, it has become a way for many members of the international community to show their commitment to democracy in specific places or globally. In one of my previous incarnations, I was in charge for a few years of the election monitoring missions of the Organization of American States, one of the several international bodies that is very visible in providing this service to democracy in different countries. And I must say that I enjoyed enormously the process of organizing and attending alongside people from all over the world, these missions. The OAS is not alone in this endeavor. The European Union and the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, just to mention two, are also important actors in this field. Knowing a little bit about how election observation missions have worked in the recent past, I can only imagine the dislocation that the pandemic has created for what had become, at least in the most serious cases, a fairly sophisticated and well-established set of processes and methodologies. To talk about the changes created by the pandemic to this essential element of the global electoral landscape, to tease out the permanent transformations from those that may prove transitory, and to talk in general about the future of international electoral observation, we have two exceptionally qualified speakers joining me in this podcast. My dear friend Gerardo Di Casa is the director of the OAS Election Cooperation and Observation Department. He's been in that position for over 6 years now. And I have to say that the OAS is very fortunate to have him. In this period, he's been in charge of more than 50 election observation missions, most recently in Suriname and the Dominican Republic, two elections held under pandemic conditions. Before that, Gerardo was in charge of different aspects of the external relations of the Electoral Tribunal and the National Electoral Institute in his native Mexico. Alongside Gerardo, we also have Patrick Costello, the head of the Division of Democracy and Election Observation within the European Union External Action Service. Patrick has been an EU official for over 20 years at the European Parliament, the European Commission, and the EU External Action Service. Before that, he worked with the United Nations, including as part of its election observation operation in South Africa. And even before that, he was a human rights campaigner in my neck of the woods, Central America. And he also hails from Oxford, which is another reason why I like him. Welcome to both of you. It is truly wonderful to have you here. Let me start with you, Gerardo. Back in the day, when I was at the OAS, whenever we organized an election observation mission, we would assemble a multinational team from many different corners of the world who would descend on a given country and disperse all over the territory in order to personally meet with political actors, electoral authorities, civil society groups, and then be present, sometimes for prolonged periods, in the run-up to elections and during election day. Well, I cannot think of any other activity whose traditional operating procedures are more counterindicated in times of pandemic. You recently were confronted by the challenge of organizing election observation missions for the presidential elections in Suriname last May and the Dominican Republic last July, both held during the pandemic. And you went ahead with the missions. How did you adapt your traditional processes for these missions? And what lessons did you draw from the missions in Suriname and the Dominican Republic?
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's great to be here, and it's great to see you, even if it's virtually. It's great to see my dear friend Patrick as well. How did the OAS adapt to the new conditions during the pandemic in the last two observation missions? And what lessons have we learned from that? I think those are very important questions. So I would say, how do we adapt? The first thing that we did is try to answer two questions, two very important questions. The first is, what information do we need to really do our work as electoral observation, as electoral observers? And the second is, how do we get that information? So the answers to those questions sometimes are different, depending on the conditions of the different countries, because we might not even be able to, for instance, in the case of Suriname, because of the way their electoral system is designed, we can't do a quick count because the system is designed in a proportional way. So a quick count is not something that we could do. However, in the Dominican Republic, we can do a quick count. So the first thing is the information that we need is different. In one, we can actually have the data for election day, and in the other one, we can't. So that affects the way we design designed our missions. The second is, what type of information are we getting from the different actors? So one of the things that we learned is that in the case of our electoral experts on different areas, political finance, gender parity, electoral justice, it was really something that we could do to have the experts working virtually. And it didn't really affect the quality of the work. They could do their reports with virtual meetings and with everything, all the information that they have online. However, the two other, I would say, legs of the observation missions, the political and the election day, it's very difficult to have that confidence virtually. Both in the meetings with political actors, we did see a very significant difference in meeting with the same actors virtually and then meeting with them on the ground. A significant difference. So that for us is something that is I think that we cannot substitute. The second issue is on election day, how do we get that information? Because it's not the same to have 5 or 6 people there, to have 60 or 70 people across the country, as you said in the beginning. So we're trying to work out ways. In the case of the Dominican Republic, we hired foreigners that or internationals that live in the Dominican Republic, and it was quite easy because of the huge tourist industry there, and which because of the pandemic has actually stopped. In the case of Bolivia, that's going to be more difficult. In the case of Suriname, that was difficult as well. And I think in some of the elections next year, that'll be difficult as well, just because of the type of profiles of the people in the country. And perhaps it's not, we can't find as many internationals that live there. So we're working on different solutions. And after Bolivia, I can probably say if those solutions work or not. I wouldn't want to reveal exactly what our plan there is.
Patrick, I can only imagine that you at the EU have also engaged in some serious rethinking of the way to go about election observation. And I would just like to compare notes with what we just heard from Gerardo. In your opinion, in the light of what you've been thinking over the past few months, what parts of the process of election observation are more amenable to be done virtually, and what parts it just need to be done in person?
Thank you very much, Kevin, and greetings to you and to Gerardo. It's good to see you. So which parts of the process of observation are more amenable to being done virtually? We of course have had some similar thinking. I mean, the legal aspects, you know, the analysis of the legal framework can easily be done. You know, you just need the laws, you know, and you analyze the laws. I think Geraldo is absolutely right when he says that virtual meetings with the stakeholders are just not the same. We have taken a rather more restrictive approach on deploying missions during this period. But one of the things that we've been trying to do is to use a mechanism we have, which is called an expert mission, where we'd normally send, you know, 2 electoral experts, sometimes 3, to a country to do an assessment, which is not a full observation, but allows a covering of what has happened without the election day findings that are impossible to get hold of. And one of the ways we've adapted that, and we've done this recently in deploying to Bolivia, is that we've increased the number of experts in the mission. So we're now sending, you know, 6, 7, that kind of size. And we're including in these teams a dedicated person who will also recruit local staff to look at the online aspects of the campaign. And this is something that's new. It's something that, because of the nature of elections during a period of pandemic, is becoming a more, ever more significant part of election observation. And therefore, it's something that can be done without being out in the field and without having long-term observers on the ground, which from a duty of care for observers' perspective and for the local populations is obviously absolutely crucial. But I think that's one important area. like Geraldo just said, we are at the moment considering whether we can deploy a full observer mission to Ghana, where the pandemic is not hit as much as some of its neighbors. But we're looking at whether we might be able to recruit short-term observers from the nationals of European member states living in country, rather like what the OAS did in Dominican Republic. And that obviously would help, because you can't observe election day with drones. It has to be people in polling stations. You know, there's no way around that. And while there are many more aspects, I mean, I think one of the ways in which election observation has changed in the last decades is that election day is still an important focus, but there is so much more going on. And what it becomes possible to look in more depth at some of these other areas. But if we can, obviously, it's better to be able to look at election day as well. And you know, there have been a number of elections where we've just decided that's not possible. We can't send a mission.
It is very interesting what you're mentioning, both of you, in terms of trying to leverage domestic resources to go about observing elections. So the inevitable question that arises from that, and I'm going to go back to Gerardo on this one, election monitoring observations are coping with international travel restrictions. So will this alone make more prominent the role of domestic observers? And here, you know, I go back to my OAS days, and I remember that often the relations between international observers and domestic observers were often fraught. And there were all sorts of people asking questions about, you know, how domestic observers, whether domestic observers were really impartial vis-a-vis the domestic political actors. So, you know, there was a measure in many cases of distrust between international observers and domestic observers. Gerardo, do you think that the current conditions will make more prominent the role of domestic observers going forward?
That's a great question, whether or not the conditions will make domestic observers more prominent. And I think it has to. We have had a lot of problems not only getting to the countries, to the point that we've had to, in both cases, in Suriname and in the Dominican Republic, we had to charter flights for the mission to travel together. But we are now being faced, and I'm sure Patrick is being faced with a similar situation where it takes maybe 30 or 40 hours for people to get to La Paz from Washington, D.C., which is, well, first of all, it's very time consuming and it's very expensive. But second, it's a risk for the people who are traveling and being in the airports for 30 or 40 hours. So it's certainly not a desirable situation while all the different air routes are reestablished. We have recognized the situation that you point out, and we, of course, have better relationships with certain national observers than with others. And we believe that some are more impartial than others and more qualified than others. That's a given. So what we have begun to do, and we've actually begun to work with this project in Brazil, but the the plan is to expand, is to work with universities, large public universities that have different departments that are already studying the electoral processes. In the case of Brazil, we are working with the University of São Paulo, with USP, that has both in several different areas, international relations, political science, law, engineering and technology, in different faculties. They're working on electoral projects, research projects, but they're doing that separately. The academics aren't working necessarily together. So the idea is to build an observatory, and we've begun to do so, in which you have a three-tier process. The first tier is the OAS coming in and training both professors and students for different things. Then having a second tier, which is the academics working together and sharing information on the election. And the third tier is to have them train students to become observers. We're just trying this out. We've begun to work on this since last year. And we hope in a couple of years to have it set up and running, and hopefully begin to do to strengthen these observatories throughout the region.
This is an excellent segue to my next question for Patrick. Gerardo is using this example of recruiting and training university students, and he just mentioned that this is something that the OAS had been doing even before the pandemic. So the question that naturally arises from that is, in your view, Patrick, is the pandemic changing radically what was done, or simply accelerating changes that were already on the way?
Yeah, I was just thinking as Gerardo was speaking, and also when you asked the question to him about domestic observers, that here is yet another example of the pandemic accelerating changes that were already underway. The general relation between domestic observers and international observers, I think, has been changing quite significantly in the last few years. I think there's a much more of a recognition on both sides of that divide of the value of the other. I think all of us as international observers recognize that the knowledge that a good domestic observer organization has of, you know, the detail local setup, is always going to be much deeper and much more profound than a group of internationals coming in for a relatively short period of time. And that at times when elections are, prepared often years in advance now, the knowledge that is built up by that earlier research is of enormous benefit to the international observers coming in. At the same time, the international observers and the domestic observers recognize that the international missions coming in have a certain kind of access and a certain kind of platform, and a perception of objectivity, which is extraordinarily useful in being able to make a statement about elections. Now, before the pandemic, there have been very significant elections in the last year or two where the lack of international missions has very much put the domestic observer center stage. I'm thinking here about DRC, Congo, where the domestic observer operation was an incredibly professionally run operation, and which had the courage to call out what had happened during that election, which was not very easy to do, and which the international community was then able to pick up on. And also international observer organizations are often able to help the domestic observer organizations in countries when they are facing difficulties with accreditation, or sometimes when they're facing direct repression. In Mozambique, last year, we faced the murder of the leader of the domestic observers. And the mission, our mission on the ground and our chief observer, immediately issued a very, very strong statement in relation to that. Just to be able to help, the observer organization overcome this horrific assassination and be able to continue to do its work. And so I think the trust is building up and there's much more of a dialogue. And that question about, I mean, of course, there are differences between different domestic observer organizations, but there is now a global network. They have their own declaration of principles. And they're engaged also in dialogue with the international observer community signed up to the declaration of principles, which OAS and EU are very much involved in. So I think what the pandemic has done is to, accelerate that process of us needing, because when we can't deploy, one of the first things that we say to our head of delegation on the ground is, if you have a good, credible local observer organization, see whether you can invest because they can deliver for you. They can do an enormous amount in those kinds of circumstances.
Gerardo, talking about the things that might change as a result of the pandemic, I cannot help but to think, and the work that we are doing at International IDEA suggests this, that as a result of the pandemic, countries are paying and will pay more attention to the whole bundle of issues around special voting arrangements. Things like postal voting, like early voting, extending the time to cast your vote, and different modalities of online voting. And my impression, at least, is that that's the kind of thing that is here to stay. I mean, you might have a different opinion, but and if so, please tell me. But if what I'm saying is plausible, how do you adapt election observation missions to a reality in which this kind of voting procedures will become more prevalent, and it will sort of diminish, in some cases, the importance of a heavily compressed election day where we all descend on voting centers and detect what's happening? I mean, it will be a different reality. How do election observation missions adapt to that sort of a reality in which special voting procedures will become more prevalent?
I think that's a great question. How do electoral observation missions adapt to special voting procedures that might have come from the pandemic or might have been already in the process of being implemented? I have to admit, Kevin, that I don't know. I think that elections are trust-based activities. And so you might think that, sure, early voting will be more prevalent. And then something is found, an irregularity is found in early voting, and then it's done with. Or you might think that electronic voting might be a solution, or some part of the constituents can vote either by mail or by internet, and then a glitch happens. There you have, we go back to the paper ballot all over again, into a normal, let's say, manual count system. What I do think is being more and more problematic is that, and we found this in different types of, I would say, irregularities, is that the electoral processes, and as we put technology into those electoral processes, are becoming more sophisticated. So then are the chances to, you know, to manipulate the election. We are not seeing, you know, sure, we see a little bit of the carousel. We see a little bit of what we call the, you know, the telling people to vote in one place and then having them not be registered there to vote, or, you know, filling ballots with additional votes. And, I mean, ballot boxes with additional ballots and things like that. Sure, those are more minor, I would say, and less prevalent. We do see those. Yes, we do see those. But I think that we have to also become more sophisticated. For instance, now the voter list issue. The voter list is issue can now, we have to be wary that it's not hacked, and that some of the data, which is now a type of fraud that we're seeing, not the entire data of the voter, but some of the data is being changed. So, for instance, a number in the person's address is being changed. The name of the street is being changed. His first name or her first name is being changed, but not the entire name. So when this person comes to vote, they don't match. The initial response of the person that is in charge of the voting in the precinct is saying, "Well, you can't vote because the information does not match," and so you're disenfranchising voters. That's one type of fraud that we're seeing, and that you have to really analyze how. How do observers, one, detect that? And two, what's the solution to that? The other type of vote is much more sophisticated as well, as what we saw in Bolivia, that you had pre-filled tally sheets with the metadata that said that those tally sheets were pre-filled and pictures were taken of that 5 days before the election even. But then that metadata was erased. And you build a system, a parallel system with servers, unreported servers within the electoral tribunal to make sure that those pre-filled tally sheets can get into the system. Of course, I think that they didn't expect their TREF to work as well, their preliminary results system to work as well in the beginning. And that's why they had to stop it for 23 hours and make sure that that they could put in all of the tally sheets that they needed to put in to have the additional votes that they needed. But those types of things we wouldn't have realized if we hadn't audited the system. So I think it's more important now, and I don't think that the international community should be doing this. I think it's important for political parties to be watchful of each other, for there to be more impartial electoral management bodies. Of course, this would not happen if you had an impartial management body working in Bolivia at that moment, and national observation, and have them audit their own electoral process. They should be the ones taking care of their process, of their democracy, and we should be secondary actors in these processes, not the main actors.
Patrick, I would like to touch on an issue that I guess in an indirect way was implicated in Gerardo's last comment. We are mentioning here different ways in which the process of deploying observers is being changed. We are, I guess, talking here about the different kinds of safety measures that should be observed by missions to minimize the risk of contagion. We are talking here, as Gerardo just did, about the increased sophistication that is called for if we want to deal with issues that arise from the more intense use of digital technologies in the electoral process. I mean, some of it as a result of the pandemic. So here, the question that arises is one about costs. I'm just wondering what the impact of the pandemic is on the cost of election observation missions. And I'm asking this question, being very mindful from my own experience at the OAS, that the budgets for this kind of pursuit have been declining for a while. So tell me a little bit about the issue of costs and how the pandemic might be impacting the cost of international election observation.
Thanks for that question on the costs. You're quite right to point out, Kevin, that that budgets for observation have been globally declining. In the European Union, so far, we've been lucky in that respect, although in the coming years, we're going to be facing a certain level of cutting across the board on external expenditure as a result of the focus in the budgetary decision by the European prime ministers on economic recovery from the pandemic. And that has an impact on our international work. So in some ways that's a direct impact of the pandemic in a way. A second direct impact of the pandemic on election observation costs is that the fact that we have not been able to deploy full observer missions, which are the expensive missions that we send, has meant that we have been spending less during this period than we would normally do. Though, of course, if we end up with a vaccine next year and a number of postponed elections then take place, that may then compensate for that. In terms of the changes that we've been talking about, and I would add, I mean, on the election technologies, this is a particular issue which again predates the pandemic for election observation missions, and that we've been discussing for quite a long time, because of the issue, if you like, of the black box. You can't observe the counting and tabulation because it's all going on in a machine. What are we observing? And the second related question to that is how does election technology, does it generate trust in itself, or greater trust in the electoral process in itself, which in the end is the key question? or can it make trust worse? And the sense that we have is that a lot of that is to do with whether the process of procurement and installation of new technologies of this kind has been done in a transparent way and involved all of the different electoral stakeholders. And that's something that we watch very closely. But both election technologies and also social media observation implies additional costs. It implies extra people employed in core teams. It implies extra local teams to observe different kinds of things. When we're talking about electoral technologies, that also requires hiring people with a certain level of professional technical expertise, which doesn't necessarily come cheap. So yes, there are additional expenses involved in those changes. But at the same time as that, the fact that the election day part of the process, while still important, becomes proportionally perhaps a less significant part of what an observation mission does. You know, the numbers of short-term observers that international missions have been sending, you know, compared perhaps to the time you were doing it, I think is probably a lot less. Part of that is because we're able to do a lot more sophisticated data analysis on the basis of smaller numbers of findings. A part of it is also because we can also, in many countries, rely on the domestic observers to have a much greater coverage and a much greater number of observers, and therefore that becomes less of an issue. So I think these changes globally probably in the end balance each other out. I don't think that this means that election observation is going to become hugely more expensive in the coming period. But I don't think it'll become massively cheaper either.
Here's a question to both of you. I understand that both the OAS and the EU will be present in Bolivia in the upcoming election. Well, the situation with COVID-19 is rather dire in the country, as in most of Latin America. So what adjustments are you hoping to put in place to ensure the success of your missions? And by the way, I'm not expecting you to give away the secret sauce, but, you know, just give us a sense, if you can, of the adjustment, the obvious adjustments that you're thinking of. You go first, Eduardo.
Well, some of the adjustments that we have thought about doing in Bolivia are the following, due to COVID-19. We're going to have a team of around 12 to 14 people traveling to Bolivia about 10 days before the election. These observers will be divided into three groups. One group will be in La Paz, one group will be in Cochabamba, and one group will be in Santa Cruz. So we will have three groups deployed in three different cities. However, we won't have, as observers, a massive deployment. We will have our experts working virtually. And then we're trying to work out an innovative approach that I don't want to confirm right now, because we're simply still working on that, and we'll probably be able to confirm that in the next couple of weeks, to have a wide presence during election day, in which we will be able to have people, a large amount of people, or a large group of people, actually gathering the information that we would gather under normal circumstances through observers. So the three questionnaires that we enforce during the day, at the opening, at midday, and at the closing, and obviously the statistical sample that we gather as well. So we're trying to adjust in that sense. It is, I completely agree with Patrick. It says that the balance of and the cost balance each other out from what we were having before traveling with large groups of people. But again, things that we have to hire now that we didn't used to have to hire. I do want to add one thing that I think is interesting. Out of the in the last month since the pandemic, we've actually been invited to 4 elections, and we were only able to deploy 2. 2 other elections, which were Jamaica and St. Kitts and Nevis, although there was the political will to invite us, and I think this is an important issue, it's not only up to the ordinary political actors that want to have electoral observation. It was actually the Ministry of Health that was not willing to be flexible in some of the requirements that we needed to be able to deploy the mission. In particular, both countries had a 14-day quarantine requirement coming into the country. There is absolutely no way that we would be able to be quarantined for 2 weeks and then work for another week. And we were not able to do that. So I think one thing that we haven't talked about, and I think it's important for us to talk about, is what role do health ministries now play both in the general election, but also in the deployment of electoral observation missions?
That's an excellent point. The point about the ministries of public health. Patrick, any thoughts about the upcoming mission in Bolivia?
Perhaps just a very quick sentence to add to what Gerardo said about ministries of health. I mean, we had to cancel the deployment in Sri Lanka, really almost on the eve, because the quarantine conditions under which the experts would have had to go in would have meant that they would have had to stay in military-run facilities for 2 weeks, and there was no way to change that. So coming back to Bolivia, and I think this is quite important also in relation to Bolivia. Bolivia is for I think all of us here a big regret, because we wanted to deploy a very significant mission to Bolivia. Geraldo knows very well, because we discussed it many times. There was a certain role that the EU could play in relation to observing these elections, I believe, in terms of, helping to restore a level of trust in the electoral process. And we had to handle not just the fact that the high levels of the pandemic meant that there were as a duty of care question about deploying observers all over the country, but also the fact that there was a big reputational risk. I mean, the idea of, if you have one Bolivian catching COVID from a European observer, the image of Europeans coming to Bolivia and spreading disease has a certain historical resonance, which we were very sensitive to and we had to be aware of. And in the end, we had to make the political decision to really reduce our ambitions. So what we have done is we've deployed, as I explained earlier, we've deployed a 6-person expert mission, so a much bigger expert mission than usual. It'll be based in La Paz. Well, they are based in La Paz. They've settled in and they're starting their work. It's not the same scale that we would have liked. And you know, their assessment of the election will be made public. Very often with our expert missions, those assessments are simply shared with the authorities. We will make our recommendations and the full report public, and that will help the follow-up. But in terms of the ability of us to help restore confidence in the process, also in different departamentos and parts of the country, that we've not been able to do, and it's just one of those things that we had to cut our losses with a great deal of regret.
Well, I mean, we're coming to the end of this very, very interesting and enlightening conversation, and I guess I have the 100 million question for both of you. When you think about international election observation, what's the future of election observation missions? I mean, once the pandemic is over, to what extent do you think international election monitoring will go back to the old normal once we have, say, a vaccine? And conversely, what changes do you think are here to stay, if any? And, you know, if you could give me a short answer to that question, that would be a nice way to wrap up this discussion. Let's start with Gerardo.
The future of electoral observation missions, I think, is already here. Part of it has to do with the pandemic. And I think part of it has to do with this post-truth era that we're living in, and this era of disinformation and misinformation. I think from an organizing perspective, I think at the OAS, having or not having the pandemic or after the pandemic, when it ends, hopefully soon, we will probably deploy less experts, and we will have those experts working virtually. But I also think, so that's a change that came with the pandemic, that we started having the experts working virtually, and I think it's worked out well. Of course, not the technology expert, not the electoral organization expert, but most of the experts. However, I think that the future of electoral observation is telling the truth about what happened in the election. We've had this issue certainly in several elections, most recently in Bolivia, in which there are other actors trying to tell their truth. And it's just not based on the facts. And I think that the future of electoral observation mission, just as at the beginning, it was a political accompaniment, and then it became a form to dissuade and denounce fraud. And then that evolved into making recommendations to have better electoral processes. I think those three things are still all true. We still accompany politically the countries. We still denounce and dissuade fraud. I think we still make recommendations to make the electoral process better. But I just think that right now the added is to have an impartial technical picture, drawing of the picture of what really happened in the electoral process. Not what one political party says happened, or another, or one think tank or wish tank thinks that happened in the electoral process, or propaganda tank. No, it's what really happened in the election. And in most elections are not black and white. There are a lot of gray areas, and there's a lot of things that one side does that aren't too good, and then the other side as well, and it's not all bad. And probably the the main challenge for electoral observation, and I'm sorry to take so long, is to balance those goods and those bads together and to reach a decision on whether is that electoral process, should that electoral process be legitimate or not.
Some thoughts about the future. Is the future already here?
I think the future's been with us for a while. I think everything Geraldo said is right. I want to focus in a slightly different direction, which relates to the situation of democracy. Of course, democracy is much more than elections. I always like to say that you know, in a way, an electoral process is the kind of health check of how the entire democratic process is functioning. It's the opportunity to see, and for an observer mission, to see whether all of those aspects and all of those pillars and principles on which a democracy is built are working. And you know very well, Kevin, and when you came to Brussels to launch the report, the situation of democracy globally, and the challenges that it's facing, and part of those relate to what Geraldo referred to in terms of post-truth. And so for me, observation, I mean, I would love to be able to say that, as I think we kind of used to say, that we, you know, we hope that international election observation missions, if they really do their job, then we put ourselves out of a job. I don't see any possibility of that in the near future. And I think more and more it is going to be important that the work that an election observation mission does in a country, and particularly the recommendations that it makes as to how the democratic process could be improved in a country against the international standards a country has signed up to, that we invest a great deal more in the other pillars of supporting that process of democracy and of consolidating and strengthening democracy at a time when it's under threat like it hasn't been for a generation. And that means much closer collaboration between the observers, the guys doing cooperation work, you know, the need to look at election observation in the context of the whole cycle. And this is something that we were, you know, it was kind of with us before the pandemic, and the challenges to democracy were with us before the pandemic. But like I said earlier, the pandemic has accelerated all of these things, both the difficulties with democracy, and we've seen the way in which the pandemic has been used in many places as an excuse to abrogate certain democratic rights in a non-proportionate way, to create more authoritarian societies. So it's exacerbated those challenges, and therefore equally the response has to step up as well. And I think that's the challenge that we're going to be facing as we go into the future.
Thank you so much, Gerardo and Patrick, for a wonderful discussion about a subject matter that happens to be close to my heart. This has been most enlightening. This is a discussion that we will revisit because, as you know, we are all learning together. This pandemic is not a one episode, but is rather like a cascade of crises that will play itself out over a prolonged period, and we will be learning lessons going forward. So I would certainly like to revisit this discussion sometime from now. In the meantime, I really wish you the best in the challenging endeavor that you're in charge of. And I certainly hope to see you in person in the near future once this madness is more or less under control. This was an episode of Ideas for Democracy, the podcast of International IDEA, and I certainly hope that all of you will come back for more and will join new discussions about the future of democracy under the pandemic and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International IDEA on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.